So welcome to Quantum Matter Frontier Seminars. So today's speaker is Professor Peter Armitage at Johns Hopkins University. He has been a professor at Johns Hopkins since 2006. As you know very well, Peter is a world-renowned expert in terahertz spectroscopy, and he used it to do a lot of pioneering experiments on quantum magnets, superconductors, and topological physics. He's also a recipient of Ludwig Genscher Prize 2016 for his pioneering work in condensed matter spectroscopy. So he's going to tell us about this new cobalt-based quantum magnet that may actually host this famous guitar of spin locket. This is something that a lot of people has been looking for. So yeah, so I think it's going to be exciting. So Peter, please go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you very much, Young Beck, for the invitation. And it's of course a great great pleasure and an honor that to give a talk. I think these kinds of regional consortiums that you, it looks like you guys have here, this is a great idea. So I'm going to tell you about work that actually goes back, some of it goes back not quite 10 years, but almost 10 years, where we started looking at various kinds of cobalt-based magnets. This story it's gotten even more interesting in recent years, both with the original systems that we were looking at in 1D chains based on cobalt spins, but also in higher dimensional systems. And so in particular, hexagonal magnet systems. And so actually most of the, where I'm going with all of this is indeed what Young Beck had made reference to. And that is the idea that maybe cobalt-based systems are, if not the best, perhaps at the very least an excellent platform for Kitaev physics, possibly realizing in some parameter range Kitaev spin liquid states. But what actually we'll spend most of the talk today discussing is the is results of ours actually on a 1D system that as always, one dimension provides simplicity, and it very often allows one to kind of distill down to the essence of some effect, whereas not giving extra complication. And so I think it's fair to say that this cobalt niobate, which is a 1D spin chain system, that I think the data I'll show you gives kind of incontrovertible proof for this kind of directional bond interaction, which people have referred to as Kitaev interaction. And then we'll take these ideas and apply it to a recent material system that we're interested in, which is a hexagonal plane based on edge sharing octahedra. So before I do that, let me thank the various people that made this work possible. And so first and foremost, my former postdoc, Chris Morris, who led this work on the 1D spin compound. My former student, Xinxu Zhang, who's now a postdoc at UCLA, and his work on the barium cobalt arsenic compound is, I think that this is also going to be a very, very interesting material to study going forward in the field. Of course, collaborations with my various colleagues, Tyrell McQueen, Syed Kopia, Oleg Chernyshov, Colin Broholm, Natalia Drichko, their various students, Yuan Tzu, and Tom Halloran. Other students have been involved with us along the way. Let's see, I'm thanking people in an odd order on the list here. Bob Kava is a longtime collaborator at Princeton. I want to special thanks to a very productive collaboration with Rebu Call, who I think I might have just seen as one of the participants on the list here. But the very last place that I visited before everything was shut down due to the COVID quarantines with the University of Kentucky, and I was giving a colloquium, and Rebu and I got to talking at the end of the talk, and I mentioned some things that I didn't understand about the results. And within just a few days, took a long time, of course, to work out the fine details. Within just a few days, we had a very nice paper, which was published earlier this year in Nature Physics, the main story of it anyway. His student, or I guess former student now, Nishita. And then we've had a productive collaboration with Thomas Ruhm at the National Institute for Chemical Physical Biophysics in Estonia. And I'll show you a little bit of the work that we did from something some years ago with Sibir Sachdev, that is to basically understand our data along with some data of, to bring in accord some data of ours with Terahertz absorption, along with some NMR data of Takashi Imai. I'm not sure if he's on this talk call or not. Okay, good. I'll give you my conclusions here in the beginning. So I'm gonna tell you about cobalt niobate, which is one might say the best material realization of Ising's model, and then concentrate on a few different results on this compound. So this is a one-dimensional chain material that up until recently, in fact, we thought was perhaps the best material realization of 1D chain, 1D Ising chain. But it is that, but it's also something more than that, as we'll see it give you evidence for the kind of some of the interesting materials there, meson bound states, what we have evidence for near the quantum phase transition, so-called Kramers-Vanier duality, a universal factor of T2 seen in the excitation spectra. And then also make a connection of this to some things that we didn't understand before that can be expressed in terms of a kitai of interaction with various structural, correlating those to various structural aspects of this material system. And then I'm going to shift from there and tell you about this material, barium cobalt arsenic 04, give evidence that this is perhaps a more ideal, let's say closer to ideal version of a Kitaev hexagonal magnet, very, very small Heisenberg and what we refer to as gamma terms, and with just a few Tesla magnetic field can induce an out of plane, what we believe to be an out of plane quantum spin liquid state, something that in materials like alpha ruthenium chloride, you would have to go to perhaps somewhere of order 70, 80 to 100 Tesla. So I hope in this talk there's something for everybody, both the real experts in the audience, some of the world leaders are here, but also perhaps there'll be things interesting for students in the audience as well. I think it's fair to say that magnetic states without long range order have been of intense interest to our field of condensed matter physics, since they were proposed to hold the essential physics of cuprate superconductors. But of course they're now an important study in their own right. Spins, we imagine some system perhaps predicated on some kind of frustrated arrangement of antiferromagnetic interactions on a lattice that has some kind of triangular motif. And if this is antiferromagnetic interaction, you realize the third spin is not going to be able to completely satisfy its antiferromagnetic bonds. And in such systems, we believe that the spins are highly correlated but still fluctuate. In this case, quantum mechanically, even down to zero temperature, at least for some of these frustrated spin systems. And in contrast to conventional order magnets, which typically break some kind of spin rotational symmetries and can be described by classical order parameters, this kind of quantum spin liquid state is characterized by topological order in the ground state wave function and long-range entanglement. A prototype quantum spin liquid was proposed by Anderson in 73, what eventually became known as the resonating valence bond spin liquid state in the triangular lattice. But there are, of course, lots of related ideas. The field has really taken off and is of interest in its own right, not just as related to what was proposed in cuprate superconductors. And the central idea is that the ground state in subsystems is effectively some kind of massive superposition of spin zero singlet pairs. Now, one of the most intriguing phenomena is believed to be that of quantum number fractionalization in such systems. So usually in a magnet, we flip a spin, and that would be, naively, would be a spin one excitation. But the idea in such systems is that the elementary excitations essentially are made up of, in a spin system like this, would be fractionalized spin one half quasi-particles that we typically know as spin-ons. And you can think of them kind of heuristically as two of these making up the conventional spin one spin flip. So if you will, the spin one spin flip falls apart into its constituent parts. Now, A milestone in the study of quantum spin liquids was the exactly solvable Kitaev model, which was reported by Alexei Kitaev in 2006. And the Kitaev model consists of spin equals 1/2 spins on a 2D honeycomb lattice with bond-dependent easing type interactions. And the Kitaev interaction, the Kitaev Hamiltonian, is shown here as this in a kind of unphysical and initially quite something which has quite a kind of contrived feel, is that in the spin interaction, that along each of the bonds in the hexagonal lattice, there is only a particular spin direction which matters in the interaction, right? So you can do this just as you like in some kind of theoretical model, but I don't know if it was thought at the time that you might be able to come up with real physical systems that do this. Okay. You can express the spin operators in such a model in terms of Majorana fermions. This is remarkable. The theoretical developments here are remarkable because it's an exactly solvable model. The ground state is shown to be a quantum spin liquid, meaning it doesn't have long range classical order. And excitations of this system can be shown to be various kinds of Majorana fermions in the pure Kitaev model, both localized and itinerant Majorana fermions. And I think it's fair to say that in building up theoretical descriptions of many body systems, exact solvable models are important despite their frequent artificiality, because they establish, if we will, the point of principle that a particular state of matter, a particular phase of matter could exist. And among other aspects, let's say this demonstrates that there's no physical principle that excludes this state of matter. However, I think that this the kind of artificiality of the Kitaev model perhaps may have been, if you will, in the thinking of the field, a bridge too far, where it probably wasn't going to be realized in real materials. And so in this regard, in a dramatic and seminal result, Jacquelli and Kalulin showed that possible edge-sharing octahedra with strong spin-orbit coupling could have this kind of bond-dependent interactions. And so the main focus for such materials has been D5 compounds like iridates and ruthenium compounds, where you get this pseudo-spin 1/2 in a T5-2G configuration. And many of these materials order at low temperatures, but the Kitaev physics is believed to be found in many of them by a broad continuum in the excitation spectrum at the Brillouin zone center. In many cases, there's interesting signatures in thermodynamic measurements, which may also be related to this kind of proximate Kitaev spin liquid physics. In one particular case for alpha ruthenium chloride, it's been shown that applying an in-plane magnetic field can suppress the magnetic order. And it's been demonstrated a so-called half quantized thermal Hall effect in a small range of magnetic fields, which suggests Majorana edge currents. So this has been a very, very active field with lots of very brilliant work ongoing, lots of interesting materials, iridates, ruthenates studied. This field, though, I think it's fair to say it's still hampered by, if you will, the non-ideality of some of the possible material realizations of this physics. And I think it's fair to say that all current Kitaev quantum spin liquid candidates deviate from they certainly deviate from pure Kitaev model, but they even deviate from other possibilities as well by the presence of significant non-Kitaev terms, such as nearest neighbor Heisenberg, which you might have right there, various kinds of off-diagonal exchanges, which are allowed even in the most symmetric cases, but though frequently you have some kind of crystal distortions, trigonal distortions, let's say, many of these systems, which allow these gamma prime nearest neighbor exchanges. One might, in many of these systems, particularly for the 4D compounds and 5D compounds, have next nearest neighbor Heisenberg exchanges. And so in the case of alpha ruthenium chloride, the in-plane magnetic field that's required to destabilize magnetic order is probably as large as let's say 8 tesla. But a quantum spin liquid induced out of plane state has not been observed in alpha ruthenium chloride or any of these materials. And critical fields as large as 50 or 80 Tesla have been proposed to induce a spin liquid state for applying the magnetic field in the kind of more desirable out of plane direction. And these large field scales are related to the large scale of some of these non-Kitaev terms. And so in this regard, discovering a material that can minimize these non-Kitaev terms is essential and is important matter. So I'm going to get back to honeycomb lattices and directional easing interactions, but I'm going to get there in a, if you will, roundabout way. So let me take a diversion through a seemingly only peripherally related topic, and that is of easing chains in transverse magnetic field. And here the experts in the audience will perhaps see where I'm going from the beginning, but I'm going to build up a dramatic tension as we go. Okay. So this is the phase diagram for the easing model in transverse magnetic field. And it's almost the simplest Hamiltonian that you could imagine, a number of spins which are interacting with each other through an easing interaction, and then a transverse field. So if you have a very, very small transverse field, the system has a twofold generate ground state. All the spins can be up, or all the spins can be down. This, in the ferromagnetic easing case, this spontaneous symmetry breaking, there's a twofold degenerate ground state. And if you put a large enough transverse field on the system, you will tilt all the fields into the field direction. And that's a singly degenerate ground state. You can't go from twofold to single fold degeneracy smoothly, obviously. And so there has to be a quantum phase transition between. So the ground state degeneracy changes as a function of transverse magnetic field. And so there's a quantum phase transition, some kind of phase transition in the ground state of the system. Quantum phase transitions, of course, are important in modern condensed matter physics. Cuprate materials, heavy fermion materials, all it's believed that quantum phase transitions play a prominent role in these systems. And the easing model in transverse magnetic field with its quantum phase transition is perhaps the simplest example of a quantum phase transition. In general, quantum phase transitions are characterized by a collapse of energy scales as you get close to the quantum phase transition. There's some kind of gap, which comes down in energy as you come close to the quantum critical point, and then back up on the other side. Okay, so we're going to come back to this. Make references to things like the intrinsic dualities in this model. Many quantum phase transitions, phase transitions in general, actually are characterized by duality relations. So a description on one side of the transition allows itself with some kind of appropriate variable transformation to a description of the variables on the other side. And that's true here, one of the things we'll talk about. In the material I'm going to talk about, cobalt niobate, there's actually the zero temperature quantum phase transition is actually preempted, if you will, by small interchain interactions. And so there's a three-dimensional antiferromagnetic state, which forms at very low temperatures. But the basic idea, in particular, when we're going to be interested in this three-dimensional antiferromagnetic state, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about the interesting physics that comes with it. But if we're at energy scales, temperatures or energy scales kind of above that associated with this weak ordering, then we're going to be mostly sensitive to the physics of the 1D chain, okay? So this material here, cobalt niobate, is perhaps the best realization we have of a 1D system, easing system that we can tune with transverse magnetic field. So this was pointed out by Radu Koldea now over 10 years ago. It is cobalt ions, which are in this kind of zigzag chain structure. It's a 3D system, and there's very, very weak couplings between the spins in the B direction, and then even weaker in the C direction, which is essentially a frustrated interaction, and we're not even going to worry about that much at all. So plotted here, this is some older data, heat capacity versus temperature for cobalt niobate and a non-magnetic analog, zinc niobate. And so you can see in zinc niobate, the heat capacity just kind of comes down in the usual fashion. This is just due to the phonon terms in the system. But around 20 Kelvin, cobalt niobate starts to differ significantly. And then you get a series of two phase transitions which occur to an incommensurate state of the lowest temperatures. This going back to the idea that we can kind of, if at least if we're at higher temperatures, we can ignore the interchain interactions. The correlation length along the chains just before the system orders is something like 100 lattice constants. So let's say at 3 Kelvin, just above the ordering temperature, it's almost ferromagnetic, almost a 1D ferromagnet in this system. Okay, so we're interested in this system and its physics. And so, as I said, it gets these ferromagnetic chains, which at low temperature get this kind of anti-ferro order that's associated with them. And so how can we understand this? Well, we know in physics and in condensed matter physics, but with spin systems in particular, that frequently the variables that you're presented are not the ideal variables to understand the system. And so that's true. It's particularly true in spin systems. And so that's true here as well. So if I have these, you know, ferro chains, which are anti-ferro correlated to the neighbor due to this weak interaction between chains, and I flip another spin, these are all excited states in the system. We don't want to concentrate on the flip spins here. We essentially want to concentrate on these blue dots, which are the domain walls between ferromagnetically correlated regions. And so you can see that in the language of the blue dots, this interchain interaction works as an effect, essentially confining potential on the domain walls. Okay. So it just linearly goes up in the interaction, in the number of spin flips between the two domain walls. But if the materials were pureizing, then that would be the end of the story. But real materials are not pureizing. There are other terms which essentially give spin flips. And in the language of spin flips, but in the language of the blue dots or these domain walls, spin flips turn into tunneling terms. So we have this linearly confining potential. We have kinetic energy that is, or this tunneling term, which is essentially kinetic energy that's associated with these blue dots. Uh-oh, apologies, my computer has just slowed down. Can you, Youngbeck, can you still hear me? Yep.
I can hear you, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I think your slide is just slow, right?
Yeah, the slide is somehow slow. I'm not sure why. I don't know what's going on here.
Yeah, maybe the movie slowed down.
I don't know what's happening.
Okay. You may try to.
Everything somehow it's all frozen with the exception of.
You may want to exit and the one share the screen and reshare.
Yeah, everything is frozen except that I can still talk to you, which is bizarre.
But your computer is working, just a screen?
Everything is frozen. Yeah, I don't know what's going on here. Let's see, Command Q is a way to typically quit an application.
Escape?
Yeah, I tried escape already. Mm-hmm. Command. This is odd. It's something.
Are you using PowerPoint or Keynote?
No, Keynote.
Yeah. So usually escape works, but otherwise.
Yeah.
Otherwise,
it's a movie that I hope. What's going on here? Keynote is somehow not responding, so I'm quitting it. And I'm going to.
Yeah, you can force quit your Keynote and.
I was trying to get it to do that earlier, but of course it's taking all these resources, and so it's. Never happened before. Oops. Okay. Those are still there, right?
So, yeah.
Okay, yeah, let me,
you can try to share the screen, I guess.
Yeah, I'm just going to quit. Safari as well, because it's somehow Zoom is. Okay, let's try to do this again.
So there are two different ways to share, right? Either you share the entire screen or you can just share the app, right?
Yeah, I've always just shared the screen, and that seems to probably should just stick with that, because that's okay. I think maybe I'm back here again. Let's see, share screen. Okay.
I can see your desktop.
Yep. Good. Okay, and I'm just going to start there. For some reason, it didn't like playing that movie. Okay. So are we? Am I sharing the wrong screen, or I'm? You see my notes here?
We see aging chain material excitations.
Okay, it doesn't slides. Say it's not the notes. Yeah. Okay. Good. Good. The point is that, as you just recall, and my apologies for that, is that you have this linearly confining interaction, and you have a kinetic energy term, and so you can map this to a one-dimensional Schrodinger equation, where there is a kinetic energy term here. If this term here was x squared, this would be solved in terms of our old friends Hermite polynomials, but it's not x squared; it's x, and so it's solved in terms of our new friends. A class of special functions called airy functions. And the energy eigenvalue structure has this particular form here, where there are these z sub j's, which are the negative roots to the airy functions. And this was all first pointed out, that in the continuum model, it all looked like this in this paper of McCoy and Wu in 1978 in Physical Review D. Physical Review D is the particle physics journal. And people were interested in this kind of physics in the context of particle physics, because this, if you will, linearly confining interaction has some resemblance, if you will, to the linearly confining interaction, let's say, between two quarks in a meson, where the bound state would be the meson and the quarks themselves are played by the domain. So the kinds of experiments that we do are time domain terahertz spectroscopy. So I don't want to get into the details of this, but we use ultra-fast laser pulses propagating on an optical table to create and detect, let me just go on from this here. I just saw that it was starting to get the little ball there. And I'll just say it in words, because I'm going to not play the movies here. There seemed to be some issue. The terahertz spectroscopy creates uses a laser to create a single cycle pulse of radiation about a picosecond long. The inverse of a picosecond is a terahertz. And so this picosecond long pulse has all this Fourier content of the kinds of frequencies that we're interested in. This technique has allowed us to measure characterized materials in the terahertz part of the electromagnetic spectrum, which was characteristically very hard to characterize materials in. The problem is typically that we don't have a dearth of terahertz radiation. Terahertz radiation is all around us, because we're swimming in a bath of black body radiation. But with this technique, we can measure and characterize materials in the terahertz range. My group has done a lot of work on this kind of techniques in the last number of years. We use the time-varying magnetic field of the terahertz pulse to couple to magnetic dipole excitations in the system. If a material has electric dipole excitations, those are typically much, much stronger, and they'll just completely swamp the signal of anything electric dipole. But if material, let's say, is electrically uninteresting, at low frequencies and has interesting magnetic degrees of freedom, then we can use those to, we can excite them with the time-dependent magnetic field of the terahertz pulse. So here's spectra here. This is a plot of the absorption through the system as a function of frequency. You can see in the sub-terahertz range or a few milliev. As we take the system and we cool down, you can see that there is this kind of increase of spectral intensity, which starts just around the 20 Kelvin, where I was pointing out earlier, these one-dimensional correlations start to form in the system. And then as when you fall below the commensurate transition, just boom, all of this sharp structure comes out. Okay, let's look at the lowest peaks. Here it's M1, M2, M3, M4, up to M9. Then there's another peak, which is kind of out of the range, out of the trend. And then there's something here that we were referring to as the M1 plus M1 continuum, but I'm going to come back to this in a moment. Let's take a look at these lowest nine peaks and ask about them. So there they are. This is their excitation energy versus some index, M1, M2, M3, M4, all the way up to M9. And there is the model of McCoy and Wu that wrote down this in 1978, where we can fit the whole discrete spectrum based on two free parameters. Really quite, remarkable demonstration of emergent physics in physical systems. Now, we took this data. We had a collaboration with my colleague, Oleg Chernyshov, where through basically exact diagonalization calculations, we can do now, we have such rich spectra that we can do things basically like the chemists and fit the spectra on the basis of a simple Hamiltonian, and in this regard, pull out wave functions, again, in a fashion very similar to that of what the, let's say, the atomic physicists might have done. Here's a plot of within the nearest neighbor Ising model of the various wave functions associated with these different excited states. So we should think of this M1, M2, M3, all the way up to M9 here as quantum mechanical superpositions of different numbers of spin flips in the system. And this kind of oscillating pattern, if you will, you can make out with your eyes. This is just the you'll recognize, perhaps those of you familiar with it, the functional form of an Airy function coming out of this Airy function solution in the continuum model. Now, a lot of that is this was physics that we were interested in some years ago, but the principal thing that we've been interested in the context of the Ising model is the quantum phase transition, where, as I mentioned, you want to tune the ground state of the system as a function of some non-thermal parameter. As I mentioned, quantum phase transitions are in general characterized by a collapse of energy scales as you approach the quantum critical point. And also, as I mentioned, many quantum phase transitions and phase transitions in general actually are characterized by duality relations. In other words, a description of the system on one side of the transition allows itself with some kind of appropriate variable transformation to a description on the other side. And that's true here as well. The excitations are of different character on the two sides of the transition. On one side of the transition, the excitations are these domain walls, as I just referred to. And on the other side of the transition, the paramagnetic side of the transition, there's spin flips. And these different, we're going to get back to this, they're related by a duality relation in which the experimental data shows experimental verification of something called the Kramers-Bonnier duality. And again, keep in mind that this system also has this three-dimensional ordered state of which we were looking at in the, if you will, taking advantage of in the previous few slots. Now, this is spectra here, plotted in a slightly different fashion and taken in a different way. The other experiments, and you'll see more data taken in my laboratory, but here in these experiments, we wanted to go up to very, very high magnetic fields. And so it's done with a slightly different optical measurement technique called Fourier transform infrared spectroscopy. And this allowed us to, we did experiments with this collaboration with Thomas Ruhn's group in Estonia, where we could go up to very large magnetic fields. Now, very often in condensed matter physics, people will try to infer the existence of a quantum phase transition from the capacity, let's say, to scale data, let's say magnetization or resistivity data, something like this. And really what they're doing when they're scaling data and trying to do data collapse is they're inferring the existence of this this energy scale collapse near the quantum phase transition. We don't have to do anything like that in this data. We can just look for the energy scale collapse directly, and it's just seen spectroscopically. It's essentially, if you will, a quantum version of critical slowing down, this collapse of energy scales as we start from the zero field case, which is down here, and apply the transverse field, and you see this lowest energy peak just kind of comes in and then goes back up on the paramagnetic side of the transition. There's a few strange things about all of this. And it's kind of, this is where my discussion with Ribu Paul centered, things that we didn't understand about the data and some years ago. One of the things that we didn't understand is that if you look at the zero field case, and I'll show you more plot on this in the next slide, there's this broad spectrum, which we understood to be, if you will, the continuum spectrum of exciting two domain walls. But that exists even for zero applied field. And in the easing model with transverse field, you have to apply a transverse field to get a domain wall motion at all. So there's domain wall motion at zero magnetic field. The other thing that's anomalous about that is as we apply a transverse field, the first thing that seems to happen is that the spectrum seems to narrow. Right? You can see this lowest energy peak actually goes up in energy before it eventually comes down. These peaks here kind of come in and narrow, if you will, before they go up in this fashion here. And so I'm going to take the next few minutes and tell you how we resolve these things. And perhaps like most good ideas, it all seems very obvious in retrospect. Here again, you can see the broad dispersion that is associated with this kind of two domain wall state. So plotted at the top is the absorption spectra, proportional to the frequency dependent susceptibility in the system. At blue, this is the low temperature state where this was again, this M1, M2, M3, M4, M5, all the way up here to M9. Above the ordering transition is this broad spectrum here. And which you can see, you know, although there's this kind of sharpening into discrete states, essentially these broad spectrum exists both above and below the ordering temperature. And therefore it can't be generated by some kind of mean field interchange interaction. Should be intrinsic to the chain. As I mentioned, this effect is absent in the transverse easing model, the transverse field easing model. In the model, strictly speaking, at zero applied transverse field, because there the domain walls should be motionless. And so the origin of this effective transverse field was unclear since early work on the system. Also, initially, we thought this region up here, this higher energy features, were actually four domain wall bound states. But this didn't make sense either, because when we applied the transverse field, their energy scales actually go up. And you can see that here. This is the kind of the spectrum plotted out of the page here. And so this is, maybe it's more clear on the lowest temperature data here. These dark lines correspond to these peaks. This is below the transition and above the transition. But you can see what happens here. You apply the transverse field, and if it was a four domain wall continuum, you would expect that the energy scales would come down, but in fact, they go up. So this was another thing that didn't make sense. And so in this collaboration with Ribu, this is what we realized, that essentially what's going on here, this is a 1D version of a Kitaev interaction. It is essentially due to the zigzag chain and the twist, if you will. So it's been argued recently, and I'm going to come back to this below later, that if you have, say, a high symmetry system, a perfect edge-sharing octahedra, D7, 3D7 cobalt ions with spin orbit coupling, you get these pseudo-spin, say, spin orbit coupled pseudo-spin 1/2 ground state, and an easing interaction with an easy axis that's bond dependent. It's perpendicular to the local cobalt oxygen exchange plane. I'm going to come back to this in detail below, but you can see how that kind of thing may be realized here. If this is a version of the, you know, a segment of the hexagonal lattice of that exhibits this Kitaev interaction with bond dependent exchanges, let's get rid of one of those octahedra. Then, if you will, moving them right next to each other, one realizes that just kind of immediately that if this has bond dependent exchanges, this one needs to as well. It has this particular zigzag with a easing axis, which flip-flops from bond to bond in the system. So inspired by these ideas, in our analysis, we assume that the cobalt-cobalt nearest neighbor interaction is restricted to the easing form, but due to the there's complex local quantum chemistry that come from octahedral distortions, we didn't constrain the directions of the easing axis theoretically. We just determined the kind of constrain them by symmetry, if you will, and the experimental input. So we can look at this in a little bit more detail here. So the basic idea is the following: is you have this chain of octahedra, and the local axis alternates sign by some angle, we'll call it an angle theta, from site to site in this fashion. So the easing axis through the crystal is determined by these two angles, phi, which is the angle that this angle phi, which is the angle that the chain magnetization makes, the C axis, and an angle two theta, which is the angle between, let's call it N1 and N2, which are the two local axes of the chain. We can infer based on past work that phi here is 31 degrees, and theta, which is, again, ultimately is going to be a fitting parameter, is about 17 degrees, right? So this theta is not the same angle that comes from just from the crystal structure itself, from octahedral canting. That angle is about 40 degrees in the structure. And so the effect of this is that it gives something like an internal transverse field, but one which switches sign from plus to minus to plus to minus from site to site. And so this solves an old mystery of this old mystery with the source of quantum motion at zero magnetic field. And so in degenerate perturbation theory, let's say for very small theta angles and large Kitaev interactions and small transverse and longitudinal fields, you can work out the kind of an approximate form of the Hamiltonian. And this in particular, we can center on this term, this index here N. And this looks like a transverse field, but one which flips sign from site to site. Okay. Around the time that we did our work, it was also identified by Parameswaran and Koldea that there should be terms like this through a symmetry analysis. And so you apply your transverse field, and you can tune these bond strengths, this bond-dependent transverse field. And from the functional form of this, you realize that there are going to be some exceptional fields where the hopping on the sites goes to zero. This has some resemblance to the Sushi-Verhegger model to polyacetylene, where you can imagine that there's some parameter in the Hamiltonian where you could tune the dimerization. From this, you typically know you're on the right track when a whole lot of other things start to make sense as well. So you can, as I said, apply a transverse field. Because there's positive bonds and negative bonds, when you apply, say, a positive external field, then some of the bonds go up in magnitude and some decrease in magnitude. And so you expect that there's some kind of exceptional field where the nearest neighbor hopping on the sites goes to zero. And so you can kind of imagine here that this is what happens. If this is the dispersion of the domain walls, you apply the transverse field and you can open up a gap in the zone center. And for some particular exceptional field, the dispersion of this band goes to zero. There's actually two ions per unit cell. There's a glide symmetry, and then when you apply the transverse field, it breaks this glide symmetry in the unit cell. You get two spin-on bands. And again, as I said, you can imagine that for a unique field, the bandwidth of each of these spin-on bands goes to zero. This gives us then three features in the spectrum of which we potentially see all three. So there is the possibility when we excite the system, we make this two domain wall excitation, and we could have both domain walls in the lower band. And that gives us kind of, this is a cartoon schematic here of some, again, for this kind of simple cartoon model of the spectrum as a function of the applied transverse field. This is the actual data right here, and I want you to see the rough resemblance between this data and the cartoon. So we can put both domain walls in the lower band. We could put one domain wall in the lower band and one domain wall in the upper band, and that's going to give essentially a flat part of the spectrum, which one can make out as a weak feature in here, or you could have, oh, terrible. Not sure what's going on. Oh, there it goes. You could have both features in the upper band, and that's this guy that goes right here. It's frozen again. I'm not sure. This is problems that I've never had before. Let's see if it goes on. Good. Okay. I go back one slide. Okay. There's a simple picture that comes if you imagine that this twist angle is small. And as I said, you can kind of work this out in perturbation theory for small twist angles. But in cobalt niobate, theta is not small. And hence the two domain wall and the higher domain wall sectors overlap and really requires a full solution to the model to really give quantitative reliability. This is obviously a hard many body problem, but one that can be attacked using DMRG and matrix product state methods. And this is exactly what Ribu and Nishito did. So on the left here, or sorry, at the top is plotted the, say, the 3 Kelvin spectrum and the 1.5 Kelvin spectrum. And below that is their calculated numerical spectrum, where the model essentially is such as to have as a free parameter the Kitaev interaction from that parameterizes the overall strength of the exchanges, and theta, which is the only free parameter in the system. So again, this theta, which here is 17 degrees, is different from the approximately 40 degrees, which is actually in the structure. One would like perhaps, and this is where I'm getting with this eventually, one would like perhaps to kind of go back and look at all the old neutron scattering or possibly new neutron scattering to see if we can possibly include the presence of all other symmetry allowed terms in the system, which I'll make some reference to below. Perhaps we can make some progress on this by combining the terahertz data and neutron data together. Okay. So as I mentioned, we were originally interested in this in the context of this phase transition. And in particular, you have this, again, the notion of the quantum phase transition in transverse magnetic field. With this added knowledge of this kind of the importance of the crystal structure, the zigzag bond, there is still a phase transition. It's still in the Ising and universality class. Sid Parameswaran and cloud writers emphasized in their paper that came out around the same time that the ferromagnetic ore in the chain breaks a glide symmetry rather than the on-site Z2 symmetry in the system. But the system is still in the Ising universality class, and an Ising model still provides a kind of intuitive feeling for what is going on in such systems. In the case for the Ising chain in transverse field, there's the so-called Kramers-Vanier duality that relates domain wall excitations on one side of the transition to spin flips on the other side. And their ferromagnetic kinks or domain walls in the system are the elementary excitations, as I discussed. In the paramagnetic side of the transition, the excitations are spin flips. And if I, let's say, express my Ising model transverse field Hamiltonian in this particular form here, where G is my transverse field expressed in, say, dimensionless fashion, the gap to make a domain wall excitation is 2J times 1 minus G. And the gap on the paramagnetic side has a very, very similar form. The difference, of course, is that I can't create a single domain wall with some kind of external field, a neutron that comes in or a terahertz photon. You always have to create two at a time. And so the domain wall itself are these very unusual non-local objects, but any local operator must make two. And so we always flip a spin, of course. And so this means that in the ferromagnetic side, generically, given some distance from the transition, we expect the gap is 2 delta, whereas on the paramagnetic side, it's delta. And this has a consequence that the gap should close twice as fast on the ferromagnetic side as it does on the paramagnetic side. And this is exactly what we find. Here's the spectra that I've previously shown you. And here I've parameterized kind of the lower edge of the spectrum, and then the upper, is the lower edge here on the ferrous side, and then the lower edge on the paramagnetic side. This is the upper edge of the spectrum, and this is again this kind of narrowing of the bandwidth that comes, we believe, from this essentially Kitaev interaction on the bonds. When you apply the transverse field, some of the bonds, their effective transverse field goes up. Some of them, the magnitude of them goes down. Let's say the negative ones, when you apply a positive transverse field, and the spectrum narrows. But eventually, if you apply large enough field, the transverse field overwhelms everything. The system, as I mentioned, is still using universality class, and you get this energy which comes down to the phase transition and then comes back up. But the slope here is half of that there. And so we measure this, you know, the experimental number turns out to be about 1.9, but this is very, very close to the universal number that's associated with Ising, this Ising phase transition, which is 2. So this experimentally measured almost 2 is, if you will, I think the kind of the first definitive direct evidence for Cramer's Vanier duality in an Ising system.
Hi, Peter. There is a question from the audience. So it's a question from Steven Nagler. Mm-hmm. Steven, do you want to speak?
Oh, that's a...
Sorry, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Well, it was just a sort of two questions in there. One is, of course, the anti-ferromagnetic Ising chains have a similar set of excitations, different in detail. Yeah. And it was found at some point that if one considered, this is by Hiroyuki Shiba, if one considered the full lowest lying set of 6 Cramer's doublets, it actually forces a change in what you would think would normally be the exchange in sort of these 1D chains of cobalt 2 plus. And in particular, it gives you some further Napier exchange that you'd otherwise not expect. And I wondered if it's possible that that also acts in cobalt niobate. And turning it around, you know, oddly enough, in those systems, there are some aspects of it that could be explained easily if you had a, even in the disordered state, some residual staggered field. So I wonder if there's an effect that's analogous to this in some fashion that might show up there.
So the question is, could you have, I guess the second part of it, could you have something like this in the anti-ferro cases?
Yeah, they're different because they're corner sharing. So it's not obvious from the geometry, but there are other things that could enter in and maybe give you something like that.
Yeah, so I'm somewhat familiar with the, indeed, a lot of the, I mean, some of the kind of macroscopic aspects of the spectrum are quite similar in these 1D anti-ferro compounds based on cobalt. You know, to what extent this analogy that we're making with Kitaev exchange interaction is valid there, I think, you know, that's unclear to me. Probably isn't, at least not except in the most vague sense. As far as the importance of next nearest neighbor exchanges, I think we do have evidence for this in the spectrum, and you can see this, for instance, it's actually not clear whether it's due to kind of Heisenberg terms or, let me go back a little bit. So here, for instance, you can see if the model was just what we said it was and there was nothing else, you would get this exceptional point here where the bandwidth of the lower the bandwidth of the lower two spin on state would go to 0. But it always has some finite width. It's perhaps not as obvious on that plot, and a little bit more obvious maybe on the next one, pardon me. Oh. Too far. Yeah, here, for instance, right here, you can see that there's some kind of finite width to this exceptional field point. And this, I think, is coming from these higher ordered, next nearest neighbor exchanges. And so whether that has something to do with what you've asked about the importance of next nearest neighbor exchanges, which are larger than you might think they should be otherwise, I don't know. We need to do a more detailed analysis of it.
Okay. Well, I posted a link to Shiba's paper in the chat, which explains. That's really a single ion effect. And for the other ones, I agree, there shouldn't be any Kitaev interactions in those corner sharing chains, but you can potentially get a sort of an existing staggered field, even in the disordered state, which is a somewhat similar effect.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Okay. Which has been debated. Okay. Anyway, yeah. Thanks.
Okay. If people are interested in this, we had some paper some years ago where we were reanalyzing some things regarding Takashi Imai's interesting paper. And in particular, this was the collaboration with Subir Sachdev, where I won't talk about the details of this unless people are really interested, but essentially what we found was that there was kind of previously recognized constraint on how the spin flips decay on the paramagnetic side of the transition, which meant that the kind of exponential activation, which was believed to exist for magnetic relaxation on the paramagnetic side, actually has the gap in the, let's say, the energy scale in the exponential is actually two times what you would expect it to be otherwise. I won't talk about the details of this unless people are interested. I noticed that there was a few hands because I started late, and then I had a few. Maybe I just go on and take the final, just maybe say the last few things and then take questions if that's fine, Young.
Sure, I see. That's better, yeah.
Okay, good. So I want to bring this back to my starting point now and talk in particular for just a few minutes about this material here, barium cobalt 2, arsenic 2, oxygen 8. Which we would propose as a more ideal cation compound. So as mentioned above, the main focus for cation quantum spin liquid candidates has been on D5, say D5 pseudospin 1/2 ions. This includes iridates and of course the celebrated alpha ruthenium chloride that a lot of people on this call have done very nice work on. However, I think it's fair to say that although this is fascinating physics, that these materials have substantial non-idealialities, and they are in many cases have issues with stacking faults, structural disorder. Particularly in the case of the iridates, there's large distortions of the octahedra, which give rather substantial non-Kitaev interactions. And it was pointed out some years ago by Liu and Kalulin and Sano, Kato and Motomoe that materials with D7 ions like cobalt, which can also possess this pseudospin 1/2 magnetic moment. And these extra EG electrons, if you will, introduces additional exchange hopping processes that are believed to strongly suppress, at least within the model, strongly suppress the Heisenberg interaction, and they give rise to a dominant Kitaev interaction in such systems. You might also believe that the more localized 3D orbitals in such systems, as compared to the ruthenium or iridate compounds, the more localized 3D orbitals might be expected to manifest smaller J3 couplings. So we got interested in this. There's a number of different materials that have been proposed, but the one that we have done our recent work on is this material here, barium cobalt 2, arsenic 2, oxygen 8. It possesses edge-sharing cobalt 06 octahedra that form a honeycomb lattice. The material was actually discovered some years ago, but was kind of brought to our attention by the very nice work of Rudong Zhang, who pointed out that it had the requisite structural aspects that may make it very a nice realization of the Kitaev compound. In addition to putatively smaller non-Kitaev terms in this system, this material has, as far as we can tell, no stacking faults or twin domains, and that's in contrast to alpha-ruthenium chloride, where those structural features can very much affect the low energy physics. Maybe just in the interest of time, I'll point out we've done kind of extensive Raman characterization in such systems, and all the phonons demonstrate a smooth temperature dependence with a normal hardening on cooling. All of essentially the symmetry allowed phonons are found and nothing else. And this is all in contrast with alpha ruthenium chloride, where the phonons related to disorder and stacking faults have been observed by Raman. So this is spectra, terahertz spectra, as I taken in a very similar way as the other data that I that I was showing you with time domain terahertz spectroscopy. So above the nail temperature, which is about 5.5 Kelvin in this compound, you find as you cool down that you get this continuum structure, which forms. The continuum is stable, let's say, with increasing temperature and persists almost a 10 times nail, almost 50 Kelvin. And this whole temperature range from 5.4 to 50 Kelvin shows evidence for this very, very broad spectrum that in other contexts, people have referred to them as a Kitaev paramagnetic regime, where the Kitaev physics is not destroyed by thermal fluctuations up to high temperatures. The continuum is eventually suppressed by increasing temperature, but it can also be suppressed by applying magnetic field. And if you apply a magnetic field, this is applied at 7 Kelvin here, you apply a magnetic field, this continuum you can see goes away and you get these various sharp peaks in the spectrum. This is a plot of the spectra at low temperature. And this is a plot of essentially the magnetic susceptibility, plotted as a function of frequency and magnetic field. And along different field directions, where according to the terahertz magnetic field and the applied field, one gets different selection rules. I won't bother getting into the details of this, but there are different features. This is for in-plane field, and one can fit them in different fashions. We believe we have this kind of spiral order at the lowest fields in this intermediate region. There's a collinear ordered state, which is seen to have a 1/3 plateau, which is observed in magnetization measurements. And again, there's various kind of selection rules that are associated with it. If you apply large enough field, which in this material is only for in-plane field is only something like a half a Tesla, you get into a field polarized regime and you get these excitations which come out, and we'll analyze these in a little bit more data below. And what exactly happens in this intermediate region, there's some evidence for coexistence of magnon peaks and a continuum there as well. So I'll just race through this at the end, but one has, if you go to do a kind of classical, semi-classical spin wave calculation on the system for the system with very large in-plane field, if you account for all of these kind of non-ideal Kitaev terms in the Hamiltonian, the lowest spin wave mode is expected to have this particular form here, which should be exact for very large fields. And you can see that it gives you a very, very precise measure of what is called, in a paper of Sasha Chernyshev, gamma total. And gamma total in this compound of 0.32 milliEV, this is about a factor of 20 smaller than estimated for this parameter in alpha ruthenium chloride. And so if we assume that quantum fluctuations in this part of the field-induced paramagnetic region were normalized parameters similar to the same amount they do, let's say, in alpha ruthenium chloride, you might imagine it's something like 0.4 milliEV, which again, as I mentioned, is about 20 times smaller than that estimated for the same parameter in alpha ruthenium chloride. The Kitaev interaction in this material, you can estimate that from the bandwidth of the continuum. And this is only about a factor of two or three times smaller than that of alpha ruthenium chloride. And therefore, one can see that this kind of non-Kitaev terms are much less, let's say the Kitaev term is comparatively more dominant in the barium cobalt arsenic system. So the final thing I just want to show is this one. And that's this comparatively small field scale that we believe we can induce an out-of-plane spin liquid state in the system. So at very small fields, you can see one has this peak structure, and we apply a magnetic field, and something around 4 Tesla here come back into this broad continuum behavior where that was taken for evidence both by us and in other contexts as evidence for it would be in particular case of a Kitaev system, multi-Majorana excitations, but at the very least, a multi-particle continuum state. It's not clear in our data whether or not we have the system has a very strong in-plane easy axis, and it's very hard to apply the field along the c direction. And so it may be that in our data we have a small in-plane field mixed in, and in magnetization data, it looked like this critical field of the out of plane applied magnetic field inducing coming out of the ordered state was something of order, let's say 10 or 10 and a half Tesla or something like that. At any rate, it's certainly much smaller than the 50 to 80 Tesla that has been proposed to be necessary to induce such a state in materials like alpha ruthenium chloride. Okay, I think I'm going to stop there. I apologize for going over. I'm happy to take questions, and I hope that I've convinced you that that this so-called Kitaev interaction is a real thing, and bond-dependent interactions. I don't know any other way to get that in the 1D chain. The kinds of spectral signatures that we see. And then showing what we're thinking about now in terms of small non-Kitaev terms in the hexagonal magnet, in this case here, barium, cobalt, arsenic. So anyway, I thank you for your attention and happy to take any questions.
Great. So we have a number of hands up. The first question is from Heian Ki.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for a really nice talk. So I have a question about trigonal distortion. And I think all of your system, at least these two, you have a significant distortion. And the reason behind this is because you claim that the gamma term is small, if the gamma is small, but on the other hand, you have easy axis, easy plane axis, that means the G factor is very anisotropic, which is coming from trigonal distortion then. So, and I think if I recall Humay and Guignard's calculation, trigonal distortion of certain magnitude, your basis is going to change. So the effective half is no longer valid. So that's the one thing about the cobalt. Another about your Kitaev chain, I wonder if the model that you use without any other, just Kitaev press the magnetic field, it's probably not a ferromagnet to begin with. So could you comment on that two part?
Okay, so with regards to the first part, I totally agree that, that's true. There's substantial trigonal distortion in both of these compounds. And I think it would be great if we basically, you know, at every point in this talk, I've assumed almost the simplest case with kind of least complicating extra factors at all. And so as you said, the basis changes, and this is the problem with the cobalt ions. We don't know to what extent these effects are significant. And so I think it would be great if this was looked at in more detail for the cobalt compound, the hexagonal compound, as well as the 1D chain. Arun Parmakenti has a paper where they've done ab initio, and they show and claim that with collaborators have claimed that these hexagonal cobalt compounds are, because of trigonal distortion, are not good versions for, are not good possible realizations for these hexagonal Kitaev systems. I have my reservations about this conclusion because the energy scales are very, very different from that calculation as actually seen in real material. Nevertheless, it's an important point, and I would like people to look at this more with, you know, ab initio calculations as well as kind of more toy models to see to what extent the kinds of trigonal distortions that are encountered in real materials really will change the physics considerably. We just don't know. The situation with the trigonal distortion gets significantly more complicated. What I would propose is a nice way forward is where perhaps the situation is less complicated, and that's the case of 1D, where if the same kind of analysis could be done in 1D, where it would be nice to do ab initio calculations for the 1D case, but also in terms of kind of more effective models, basically looking to see how you mix other states in as you distort the octahedra trigonally. It would be nice to work this all out there and get some intuition for how important these effects are, and perhaps a both better theoretical job and experimental job could be done in that case. Then there was a second part. Did I answer both parts?
You answered one part, the ferromagnetic model that you...
Oh, the ferromagnetic, yeah. So, sorry, but is the question you're asking, is it ferromagnetic in chain, along the chains?
No, you have a Kitaev, you have a model which has a guitar across the field. In that case, because the system is a ferromagnet to begin with, and if I just have isotropic, I know the guitar have changed, but yours is different because your N is changing between the bond. So it's like a very much anisotropic guitar with a gap without the field. But your case, you have ferromagnet in the system. Isn't that right?
Yep.
So you need other interaction probably to have a ferromagnet as a ground state without the field. So in the absence of field, your ground state is ferromagnet.
In the absence, which field? You mean the like a longitudinal field?
Well, none of them. So let's say that I have no external field. What's the ground state of the chain?
Ferro. It's I don't think there's a problem with that. There's a competition between the two bonds. They're not plus or minus 45 degrees.
Right. So my question is,
so if they're a little bit canted. And so,
so if I have a Kitaeve interaction with the KX and KY with a slightly different angle, am I going to get a ferromagnet as a ground state?
Well, in the, I mean, if we think of our case of the physical system as something intermediate to a, you know, to like a real Kitaev chain, where it would be plus or minus 45 degrees, and we, that's our angle theta in the model. So if we let that angle theta go to zero, it's just the easing chain. So the ground state's a ferromagnet. If the ground, if the chain is, if that angle theta is something, if it's 45 degrees, then you kind of get this sick 1D system that has all of these degeneracies in it. That, but if it's not, if it's somewhere between zero and 45 degrees, then the ground state is a ferromagnet.
Okay. I
don't think that, that there's an issue with this. You know, clearly if it's almost easing and you allow a little bit canting, I think that's still a ferromagnet. Do you disagree?
Because I thought that you had a Kitaeve interaction, not the Heisenberg interaction. So I'm now confused. So,
Maybe we can talk about it.
Okay, so the next question is from Daniel Komsky.
I have a question about the first system. If indeed you have alternating Ising-like or Kitaev-like interaction from bond to bond, can you apply magnetic field in direction of Ising direction of one bond? Then it might be, it might look like staggered field. It might be, for example, transverse field in one bond, but it will be longitudinal field for other bonds. Did you try to do it?
So if we apply a transverse field,
you have different bonds, and a Kitaeve-like term is perpendicular to particular plaquette of each bond. So different directions for different bonds. So if you apply magnetic field in direction, which is Ising direction for one bond, but which is a kind of transverse direction for other bond, or maybe tilted at least, then it might be like a staggered field.
So
for one bond and transverse for
another. So something like this may be possible if we really just truly had a an isolated chain. And so that would be, you know, that's perhaps important to do from a theoretical perspective. For the real material, we have a number of zigzag chains, which are, which have, you know, kind of some different symmetries related between them. And what
they
is,
not all identical.
I don't think that there's a unique direction that we could point the field along one of the bonds to make it, say, purely longitudinal and the other one's mixed. In this regard, it would just completely be in some completely weird direction that didn't have any particular symmetry associated for one of the other chains in the system.
So you say that chains are not identical.
Yeah, they're not
identical. Orientation are different.
That's a simpler way of saying what I was saying.
Okay. I see. Thank you.
Right. So there was an earlier question from Christian Chung. Do you want to ask a question?
No, that was an accident. Sorry.
Okay. All right. Actually, I have a quick question. So do you have magnetic susceptibility data along different magnetic field orientation? And that may tell you like how large all of these anisotropic interactions are in this cobalt material?
Yeah. So the so I don't have a plot for it now. We're taking the out of plane susceptibility data, right. But it's proven to be hard to do because of the strong in plane anisotropy, right? So the crystal wants to twist. And so it's hard to it's been hard to do a measurement that where we know we have pure out of plane field.
Mm-hmm.
So even for the measurements that I showed, it's presumably there's a little bit of a mixture of an in plane component because the crystal always wants to always has a torque on it and wants to bend in field. So it has to be done in a particular fashion, and that's being done now, but hasn't been done to our satisfaction yet.
But so in the ordered phase, right, when there is no magnetic field, do you have any idea about the direction of the moment, for example?
So there's a spiral state, but it's the spiral is, I mean, it's in plane. If that does that answer your question?
Yeah. Right. Okay. I see.
Yeah, it's in plane. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's strongly in plane. There's this strong in plane anisotropy.
Mm-hmm.
And what is the value of moment, orbit moment by neutrons?
What is the value of the ordered moment from neutrons?
How good is the approximation of effective spin one hole?
Yeah. So we don't have it from neutron. There hasn't been good inelastic neutron scattering done yet. Those experiments are being done right now. So we don't know for sure.
There is a question from Adam Chen. You want to ask a question?
Yeah, thanks. So this is a question from the earlier part of your talk when you were introducing alpha ruthenium chloride. You said that it might be more desirable to apply an out-of-plane field instead of an in-plane field. I'm just curious why you say that's the case.
I could think from a theoretical perspective, I don't know, more desirable is perhaps not the right way of saying it, but from a theoretical perspective, it can be different. It's also, from an experimental perspective, often this is an easier experiment to do, to kind of expose the measurement, the flat plane of the crystal, if you will, to particularly for optical experiments. It can be easier to apply the flat plane of the crystal to magnetic field in this regard.
Yeah, okay. Just to
I should say it's not desirable necessarily, but it's different.
Right. Just to add something to that discussion. So in theoretical calculations, some people found some kind of intermediate spinnaker-like phases when you apply a field out of plane. But so far, none of the theory calculation find the strong evidence of quantum spinnaker with an in-plane field. So in that sense, from theory point of view, right, there is a more likely to be a spinnaker out of plane magnetic field. I think that's what Peter was reporting to.
Yeah.
Okay. So
I see. Thank you.
So one of the hands are still up. So hey, do you have another question?
Yeah, so sorry if your time is okay. So I think if your angle is pi by 2, that'll be corresponding Kitaev chain, right?
Yeah.
Right, so then you will have a transition of the ground state as a function of angle theta. Have you checked that, like going from Fero to something else?
No, but in our case, right, it's not pi over 2, it's something else. And so was this what you were getting at? Was that it?
Yeah, I'm trying to understand where your system is all has like a ferromagnet, and there we know that Kx, Ky is just isotropic type chain, which are just it's a critical, it's a gapless chain. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if you stay immediately away from theta of 90 degree, you just going into the ferromagnet, or you have a series of other phases in between without the field?
Yeah, I don't know. I think there's a paper by Andres Olesh, which maybe addresses something on this point, but I'm not sure. I mean, if Ribu is on the call, maybe he has a comment.
Yeah, I think classically the ground state is a ferromagnet up to pi over 2 when it becomes degenerate. And at least in DMRG, now it gets harder to do it close to pi over 2, but In certainly up to a very large angle, it's very clearly a ferromagnet. So there may be some small window of something interesting happening around pi over 2, but it's very small and certainly very far away from 17 degrees.
Well, the actual material is not a 17, by the way. It's a 40 something because anyway, it's a structure.
Yeah. So, and that's an important point is that, you know, the.
So your model is actually a model yet still.
Yeah, it's theta is just constrained as a easing axis is just set as a free parameter. Yeah,
right. It's a set by a structure of the lattice. Neutron is not there. Like if you look at the trigonal distortion in a neutron of this cobalt 8, it's trigonal distortion is very important here. Mm-hmm. The neutron on the local excitations between the J effective half and 3/2 excitation is separated. I mean, it's about 30 MeV will be really enough to justify your analysis. Mm-hmm. And that should be detectable by a neutron.
You're talking about the crystal field?
Yeah, the trigonal distortion, the size of that. That's because the cobalt has a synovial coupling is about 20 MeV in this three holes. So if the trigonal distortion is probably twice bigger, let's say 40 MeV, you can still apply your analysis here. But if you go like 90 MeV, I would say that this basis is not a right one to begin with.
Okay, yeah, thanks for the comment. I will look into it, and if I have questions, ask me.
All right, Daniel's hands is still up. Do you have another question, Daniel?
I'm sorry, that's probably from the previous slide.
All right, so thank you very much. I think that all the questions are now answered. So if there is no other question, then I'd like to thank Peter for a really interesting talk.
Yeah, thanks, Peter.
Thank you very much. Thanks a lot.
To see people in person sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah. So then, you know, then we get an even more lively discussion.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. Good.
Thank you.
Thank you.